Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're looking a little bit more closely, as we did last week, at the treatment of those considered to be enemy or deviant classes in the Soviet Union during the late 1920s into the mid-1930s. We're looking again at Sheila Fitzpatrick and Everyday Stalinism. And here she talks about the concept of class warfare during the Stalinist period. And it was often Soviet communists, the Stalinists in question, that believed themselves to be the endangered group, the people who were most likely to be done away with come some blood-soaked counter-revolution. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "In the late 1920s, Soviet communists believed themselves to be under attack from resurgent class enemies." And I think the resurgent bit there is key. "The old bourgeoisie, the new NEP bourgeoisie, kulaks, and even the bourgeois intelligentsia." Now, in the last podcast I did on this subject, I talked about how the old classes, the former people, the former czarist aristocracy who had survived the revolution, the former czarist government ministers and officials, the Orthodox priesthood, how they had survived into and maintained a low profile in Stalinist Russia, and how their existence constantly fueled the sense among Stalin and his lieutenants, his commissars, that the business of the revolution was undone, was not finished, it was not complete, and that there needed to be some kind of cleaning up operation, some kind of attempt to catch those who had slipped through the net, because they were a constant threat. Now, from what Sheila Fitzpatrick says, is that the old bourgeoisie, as she puts it, the new NEP bourgeoisie, the people who had been made wealthy through the NEP, the net men, the black marketeers, the kind of the smugglers and the spivs, that they were now, having not been eliminated since the establishment of the NEP, and the question of the NEP having been left open following the death of Lenin in 1924, and finally answered with reintroduction of massive state controls in 1928 as a result of the ascendancy of Stalin. These enemy classes had been created by the unfortunate compromises of the NEP, as it was seen by the Stalinists, and now must be dealt with, along with the kulaks who had developed in economic strength throughout the 1930s. All these new enemy classes were the results of the revolution not having been done quite right. The first, the old bourgeoisie, having not been got rid of in 1917, and these two new, the NEP, bourgeoisie, and the kulaks, being the result of the imperfect missteps of Lenin and the unfortunate compromises that had to be made throughout the crisis of the Civil War era. Just for clarity, for those who aren't familiar with Soviet history, perhaps I should say, the NEP was the New Economic Policy. The New Economic Policy had replaced the era of war communism, which was the totalitarian and largely counterproductive attempt to control the economy in order to win the Civil War, which resulted in the first Soviet famine of 1918-21. So referring to these fears that the party had about class enemies and about being under attack from class enemies, Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "To all appearances, however, this was the opposite of the truth. It was the party that had gone on the attack against class enemies, just as it had done during the Civil War. NEP men were being forced out of business. Kulaks were accused of hoarding grain, forbidden to join collective farms, and finally marked for liquidation as a class, which meant expropriation, eviction, and often deportation and imprisonment in labour camps. At the same time, the church was under attack, with large numbers of priests under arrest and churches closed down. The intelligentsia was in trouble too, harassed by militants of the Cultural Revolution and liable to be accused of disloyalty and even treason. All this meant hard times for anyone bearing the stigma of bad social origins. During the Soviet elections of 1929, conducted under the slogan of class war, more people were deprived of the vote than ever before. In 1929 and 1930, government officers were purged and to remove the disenfranchised and other social aliens. This process often involved humiliating public cross-examination. A sympathetic reporter described how a taxation official stood up to this. A small, clean-shaven old man who was educated in a respectable general's family and in the Tsarist Ministry of Finances, he holds himself on the tribune with dignity. 12 years of the October Revolution changed this man very little. Today, from the tribune, he makes his statement about his understanding of the purge. If I am not needed, if I don't suit, tell me and I will go. But why throw dirt on me?" So this process of public humiliation, of denouncement, of the forcing out of enemy classes, this is a kind of a tiny stirring of the great terror that would eventually come. What tended to happen is those who had been denounced and deprived of their jobs, their homes and their social standing would be revisited during the period of the terror because there would be a record of them. The terror is an immensely bureaucratic process, and being able to have names already in the system is extremely important. The families of those who were denounced or who were seen to have bad social origins were also targeted. Children were expelled from schools. The novelist Mikhail Aprishvin wrote in his diary that there was even a class approach to the dying. In the hospital, they are throwing out three patients who've been found to be disenfranchised. The disenfranchised persons found it difficult to get or hold jobs. When rationing is introduced, they were ineligible for ration cards, and so they have to buy food at commercial prices, so they don't receive the kinds of state subsidies that favoured workers do. The rationale behind that was that if you penalised the bourgeoisie, if you penalised people with bad class origins, and you were sympathetic to those with supposedly good class origins, then there would be some kind of, hopefully, some kind of atonement, some kind of transformation in the bad types of people. And at least with the people with good class origins, they would understand that the revolution was theirs and was designed to work for them. Obviously, this doesn't really manifest itself in
anything other than kind of like state-led, food-based, resource-based sadism. In 1929, the telephone service in Moscow to the non-toiling elements was cut off. It was basically argued that the telephone system was overburdened, that it was at breaking point, and that those that worked deserved telephone privileges and should have telephone privileges because they were important members of society, and those that did not, the speculators, the exploiters. Not that anybody is in any position to do any speculating or exploiting at all, because most private property has ceased to exist. Certainly most private capital, private businesses after 1928 don't exist. So this was a way of appealing to a working class support base in persecuting those who had been formerly of the wrong kinds of social class. In the autumn of that year, the Moscow Soviet began to throw out non-toilers from their municipally owned apartments, though even party members believed that this was illegal. So what had happened over the previous decade is that privately owned property, privately owned apartments had become crammed with workers, crammed with working class families, and people who had often owned or lived in spacious apartments found themselves living in now perhaps one room of their own home, while the rest of the house was shared by large numbers of strangers, many of whom had eyes on expanding the space that they inhabited or forcing out the original owners of the house altogether. And in 1929 this became possible because of people having bad class backgrounds being evicted from their homes. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "The drive against class enemies seems to have had more solid support in the lower ranks of the party than the leadership. The head of the Soviet government, Alexei Rykov, and other Politburo members, soon to be ousted as rightists, had serious doubts, as did Mikhail Kalinin, the former head of state. Avril Enikidze, another highly placed government official, who was known for generosity as a patron to former people, was outraged, as were leading education officials in Russia and Ukraine, and Lenin's widow, Nadezhda Krupskaya." I always find it particularly interesting when you begin to look into the internal politics of totalitarian regimes and find that far from the entire regime singing from the same hymn sheet, far from there being a consensus when it comes to repressive policies, there are all sorts of different views, from the sadistic through to the relatively magnanimous. There are those who, by and large, agree with the spirit of the repression but see it as being unnecessary or perhaps a misstep. And there are those who believe that the revolution was about certain things but surely not about others.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And it presents to us totalitarian regimes, not as these great monoliths, but these kind of complicated messes, these complicated human messes that are more common among the kinds of things that people create than the sort of the monoliths of our imaginations. The tide of party opinion was generally against people like Nadezhda Krupskaya and Kalinin and Rykov. The overall, the treatment of the former bourgeois classes was seen as being entirely justified by the more lower members of the party rank and file. These were, by and large, first-generation working-class Bolshevik members who had tended to join the party in 1917-1918 during the revolution and the early period of the Civil War. A letter on the plight of priests that was sent by Kalinin to Orjonikidze, Sergo Orjonikidze, complaining about the local authorities and that they were and their tendency to behave with complete arbitrariness towards priests, spelt out how the priesthood and other people whose rights had been disenfranchised were being ignored. The letter said, "All the efforts of local authorities are directed towards de-kulakizing ministers of religion along with kulaks. This illegal de-kulakization is conducted under the guise of taxation. They try to tax ministers of religion in every possible way and in such amounts that they cannot fulfil the demands made on them, and then all their property is confiscated, even necessities for the family, and for the and the family is evicted. Clerics and members of the of their family have been drafted to work at logging enterprises, regardless of sex, age or health. Sometimes this harassment of members of the clergy literally becomes mockery. For example, there have been cases in Barnaul district where ministers of religion were conscripted to clean pigsties, stables and toilets." Obviously, this was a kind of a militantly atheistic regime, but that certain lower levels of the of government, particularly at local levels, there was more than an element of a personal enjoyment of the humiliation of the priesthood. There were members of the of local Soviet governments who seemed to take a distinct pleasure in forcing priests, who they by and large viewed as liars and hypocrites, to clean stables. It's interesting, if you read Orlando Feige's Russia, a People's Tragedy, when he discusses the nature of peasant society in Russia prior to the revolution, despite the fact that you have many millions of devoutly Orthodox Russian peasants, the priesthood themselves are often seen as liars and swindlers or interferers in peasant life. So the propensity for priests to be treated badly or to be treated in a kind of a cruel or sadistic way after the revolution was prevalent, not just because of the party, perhaps not even because of the nature of local government, but perhaps because of the reputation that the priesthood actually had amongst the ranks of the poor. When Stalin, for example, was written to by Inukidze, that letter described the situation of the disenfranchised as utterly desperate, forbidden to work, refused rations, and their children expelled from school. And in the countryside, peasants often refused to shelter people with poor class origins at their inns and hotels and hostels. The fact that letters like this are being written to Stalin, again, tells us something interesting about Stalin himself. Stalin did receive vast amounts of correspondence that were not necessarily to his liking, to his interest. And some of it, he listened to. Stalin is a kind of a curious, mercurial, changeable character who historians have often found it hard to pin down. A ruthless sadist, a manipulator and an opportunist, of course. But sometimes a figure who would make exceptions for some individuals that he particularly liked, particular novelists, writers and artists that he thought were worthwhile. There were those who he was certain it was unnecessary to persecute. There are moments where he backtracks in certain policies. There are moments where he accelerates. He is a highly changeable character. Protests also flooded into the office of Kalinin. For example, in the first 2 months of 1930, 17,000 complaints of unjust deprivation of voting rights were received from the citizens just of the Russian Republic. In the corresponding months of 1926, there had been 500. Most of these complaints focused on the disenfranchisement itself, as opposed to other penalties that came after it, such as eviction from apartments, expulsion from trade unions and educational institutions. So again, this tells us something very curious about the Stalinist regime, that you could write to the head of state to complain. It is worth pointing out that this is 1930. It's not the height of the Great Terror in 1937, where people certainly wouldn't be writing those kinds of letters. Letters were read and they were archived. How much good came to the writers of those letters is a kind of like a very debatable area, but the point is that people felt it was possible to write them without extreme fear of consequences, that they were writing not because they viewed themselves as class traitors or subversives who they needed clemency from the state from, but because they generally believed that they were none of these things, and they viewed themselves as loyal Soviet citizens who were being treated unfairly. A secret government decree in the August of 1930 argued that people who had been disenfranchised or had been removed from their jobs in recent purges should not receive any kind of unemployment benefit. They should not be able to register at the Labour Exchange, which was the Soviet equivalent of the job centre, along with everybody else. And it said they should be sent to timber camps, peat works, shovelling snow and other jobs, and moreover only in places that are experiencing an acute shortage of labour. When education ministries in Russia and Ukraine forbid any sort of social purging of schools, they were just ignored. Schools went ahead and did it anyway. Why? Because it was part of a way of the schools demonstrating their commitment to revolutionary ideas, which in their mind rested above day-to-day policy compromises. It was a way of demonstrating kind of ideological and social zeal. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "One local Soviet, emboldened undoubtedly by the active support of the local party organisation and the tacit support of the Central Committee, even wrote back to the centre describing how beneficial it had been to expel 86 high school students, almost half of whom had disenfranchised parents, and explaining why it proposed to disobey the Russian government's instructions to the contrary. They are all sons of big hereditary kulaks, and some of their parents have been sent to Solovki," that meant the Solovetsky Islands gulag. "In the great majority of cases, these kulaks' sons were instigators in stirring up nationalism, spreading various kinds of pornography, and disorganising study. All these 38 persons hid their social position while they were in school. registering themselves falsely as poor peasants, middle peasants, and some even as agricultural labourers. At the same time, children of workers, poor peasants and agricultural labourers could not get into school because there were no free places. The population is extremely pleased with what we have done. And there you have, again, some really interesting power dynamics, referring to the population being extremely pleased with what we have done. There's an element of kind of a populist playing to the gallery there. And there's also an element of trying to interpret what it is the spirit of the revolutionary moment kind of is, ignoring what some stuffy bureaucrat in the state government says, and looking to the national Soviet government and trying to get a sense of what it is that national Soviet government is really saying, what the what subtext they are tacitly hinting at is okay and acceptable and permissible in the treatment of others. Okay, we're going to finish now in a moment, but I'm really fascinated by this kind of journey through class dynamics in the Stalinist era and looking at class-based persecution. And next in this series, we're going to move on to the question of deportation and exile. And we get closer and closer to examining life in the Soviet camps. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.